Welcome everyone who's joining. As you all know, today we'll be speaking with Clinton Farmer and Keith Draghi about the Duke John Sandalwood Oil Project, which is a really interesting initiative that has won the UN Equatorial Prize for innovative solutions to addressing indigenous livelihoods and nature-based economy. Clinton Farmer is a self-employed sandalwood harvester, and he manages and operates the Kutgububa Aboriginal Cooperation Indigenous Martu Harvesting Enterprise. He's also a director of Duchan Sandalwood Oils and chairman of the board of the Duchan Foundation. And Keith Draghi is managing director of WA Sandalwood Plantations. Keith immigrated to Australia in late 2000 and with Ron Mulder founded WA Sandalwood Plantations. Keith oversees WASP's commercial management, including investor relations, finance, and sales. He graduated in chemistry from University College London in 1986. So it's my real honor to be here with both of you and to learn more about both the work you're doing and this partnership that you have. And Keith, Clinton, I wanted to start with you and see if you could just begin talking some about Australian sandalwood and how it grows and just your tradition of harvesting, how you go about harvesting them.
Sandalwood, we call it Darjan in our language, native language. It grows out on our homeland, which is in the Gibson Desert. It's been part of our people for generations, for thousands of years. It's special to our culture. When we harvest, or when we do it in a sustainable way, so that it's there for the future, you know. We've always had that in place from the beginning. As Indigenous people, we've always been sustainable and we do things. And sandalwood is special to our culture. And we've used it for medicine. When we burn the branches on the fire, old people just use it to breathe it in during the colder months because it gives off lots of heat. It's keep people warm. And also the old people just use it. It when they breathe it in, it calms them and for cold and flu. And because our old people living a nomadic traditional lifestyle back then, well, they didn't like, you know, the rain. When the rain come, they used that to make the rain go away. So they had a special song with it. So they will sing it and smoke goes up like a prayer. And then the old people used to make it go away, make the rain go away. And also the seed was used for when old people had used to fight, or if there was a spear wound or any skin infection, they used to use it to warm the seed up on the fire and grind it, and then just rub it on. It forms into a paste, oily paste, and then they rub that on the skin infection or the wound to heal up. So it's a part of our spirituality. It's really special part of our culture. Like all plants and animal, but for sandalwood in our culture, in the desert homelands, from my tribe, yeah, it is really special part of our life. When our old people was living back in the desert, living a traditional nomadic lifestyle. And we still got that knowledge today that when we harvest, the old people passed it on. When my father got his license to harvest off the government when I was born. And so it's been part of my life from the beginning, you know, but it was always part of our culture and always special to us. And we will always protect it, like animals and plants, we'll always protect it so that it's always there. We will never let it become extinct.
Can you talk some about how your father, his dream of an Indigenous brand, and how you said he came out and he had the first contact and then has brought you all back?
Dad was with a group of old people who walked in from the desert, and he was first contact, which means there's the first group of people who seen white people back then when they walked out in the desert. And what happened, the history there is when the Australian government and the British government was testing nuclear bomb and testing the long range rockets back in the 60s, 50s and the 60s. And it created fear for our people. So our people started moving away. So it was like a great exodus from the desert. Our people started moving from our homelands because of that. It created fear because they seen these foreign objects, you know, flying over. And then Dad moved, and with the old people, they all moved. Majority of them came to Wiluna, which is a small town in Western Australia. A lot of our families and people scattered. They was scattered through the four winds, north, east, west. But majority of our people came to Wiluna and settled in Wiluna. And this is where we are still based today. So when Dad came and came and learned and grew up and went to school here and had to learn a new way of living, you know, after living a nomadic lifestyle. So our old people had to learn quick a new way of living after living in a real harsh environment out in the desert. Life was hard. The land was, it is one of the harshest environment in Australia, on this continent. And there's 10 deserts in Australia. Gippsland Desert is one of the driest. No permanent water, but the knowledge was passed on how to survive in a harsh environment. And we still, the young people still have that knowledge now today to survive. And and our old people had to work hard and learn a new way and to fight also to get our land back so that we can go back and reconnect the land to our country, to our homeland. Land is important to us because it is, without our land, I wouldn't be here today existing. And now I continue to stay on land and continue to harvest on my country and continue to caretake and practice what my old people has passed on to me, what my dad has taught me. And back then when we started working, when Dad started working, the money wasn't good, but it was a way that Dad was used and created employment to get us back onto the land, get our families back on the land, because he's seen the danger of living in, like coming to Wiluna was foreign land. So it was belonged to another tribe. So Dad felt that he needed to go back and reconnect to country and was wanting to create employment so that people, our families, our people can go back to reconnect to our land and get strong again and heal again.
Thank you. I want to ask more questions about that, but before doing so, I wanted to draw Keith, you into the conversation. If you could talk a bit about sandalwood in Australia and the role of plantations a bit.
Certainly. So really the kind of plantation environment for sandwood in Western Australia began to develop in the late 90s, early 2000s, with some quite strong policy directives from government at that point. Simply, as often happens, where you've got old growth logging in an environment and you want to encourage and create investment into a plantation renewable resource. There was strong government policy around that back in that time. And really that was one part of the reason that myself and my business partner, Ron, started on our kind of journey in sandwood. But it also emanated out of the fact that European settlers that came to Western Australia back in the early 1800s, you know, brought their European farming techniques with them on difficult to work country out in Western Australia, and so cleared significant areas of remnant bushland, of which the West Australian sandalwood species, Santalum spicatum, was scattered throughout what is now the wheat belt. So that wheat belt area of WA is a massive grain producing area for the country and a significant global producer. But, you know, it kind of came at a cost that the removal of all that remnant bush obviously created over time salinity issues. So when we first began, my business partner Ron was kind of into land care services. He was working with farmers who were suffering from salinity issues and soil erosion, and started to put in varying tree belts and a level of regeneration of trees into the system to try and improve the overall farming climate there. And of course, Santalum spicatum was one of those naturally occurring trees in that environment. And so that kind of then led into this connection between a depleting resource, a hungry market, a government policy around a transition to a plantation resource. And those things kind of just aligned. And our kind of what we saw as an opportunity then was to kind of bring those things together, really. It's not like we were inventing a new marketplace. The traditional sandalwood, the wildwood that Clinton deals with, you know, is a very distinct type of product. But there was a clear, you know, an obvious requirement to start to transition to this plantation environment. And we felt that growing a native tree in its native environment, you know, would be a simple dot-to-dot process. Of course, it always turns out to be somewhat more complex than that, but that was the essence.
Great, thanks. And
I wanted to mention that on our homeland, we have the oldest sandalwood in the world, up to 200 to 300 years old. And yeah, they're still growing today. And those ones we don't harvest, so we use the old trees to continue the species. When the seeds come on, we use that to replant. And when we harvest, we only harvest the ones that are mature. The old trees and the young trees, we don't harvest, only the mature age one. That and because it's such a harsh environment, when the trees go into stress, that's when the trees produce the best oil. So our being right out in the interior, right under the Gibson Desert, that's like Keith was touching on that our wood is the best quality. There's no else in the country or in the world because it grows in the harsh environment. And we've got the whole oldest trees out there, and those trees will always live there and continue to have for the future, you know? It's like I said, it's really special for us. And we call them trees, the mother trees.
Can you say more about how the role of the mother tree and what you harvest and what you know not to harvest?
With the mother trees, they are left there to continue to grow, and they are over 300 to 400 years old. and they are still growing still. And there's many out there that we've left. And what my dad has passed, left, so that's our way of leaving the trees for, you know, and harvesting sustainably. So when, like I said, when we harvest, we only harvest the ones that are mature, not the old trees, and only the one in the middle, not the young ones. So they would be bad, you know, 50, maybe 70, around about that age. Young trees also, that when the seeds come on, we use them also to replant. But so we slowly getting more into it, but the old people used to do that years ago. But now, and then when Dad was harvesting, so the trees that Dad left behind was young, I'm harvesting now. And there's still trees that are still old, still out there, and a lot of areas that are untouched, that are virgin country, that we will continue to look after as custodians for the tree and custodians of the land. That's special to us.
Can you say more than about, so Duchan Sandalwood Oils, that's the company that you then sell the sandalwood to? Can you talk some about the enterprise part of this initiative?
Duchan Sandalwood was, we formed a Duchan Custodians, and then we, it was a long-term vision, dream that Dad had, because when we first started, we was harvesting under government contract, and which is for selling, the money wasn't too good, so, and we was also fighting to get our land back, but Dad was only focused on, back then, was on the harvesting side, but his long-term dream was one day wanting to, you know, look at when they started looking more into the oil and the quality and all that, when we started looking at, and then we wanted to create the indigenous brand, and then we thought, you know, Dad thought that we wanted to one day create a company, and then using a traditional name that come from our tribe, and Darjan is the word now for sandal, and that way we, that's when we start form that Darjan Custodians. And from there, the contract was coming up from the government to, for any company to bid for it, to get into the next part of the valuating part where you extract the oil and sell it. And that's when we seen that opportunity. And in the beginning, we, you know, we went to a few companies in Australia, but we felt that they wasn't listening to us, and they wanted to do things their way. And we didn't want to go down that path, because we've always been in the past exploited as indigenous people. So we felt that we wanted to find a company that was gonna work with us and respected our ideas and respected us as a people and wanted to work with us, so, and develop that idea of that indigenous brand. And that's when we met with Ron and Keith, and being a Western Australian company, and we've seen that they was, you know, doing their part in looking after land in their way, and we felt comfortable. And then that's when we joined with WASP, and then we created Duchan Sandalwood Oils, and then from there it took off then. And it's been an amazing journey, you know, from last year, old people came in when I was, the year I was born in 1977. So it's been a long journey, and it's been a hard journey, but a special story was created from that journey. And many people joined us in this journey. And people like Ronan Keyes and many other people who joined us on this journey. And you know, eventually we created this company that's out there now telling the story. Before, people was using our stories and our images, but now we the people are telling the story now, like what we're doing tonight there. It's been an amazing journey and a special one.
Right, there's so many people talking about the importance of partnering with Indigenous communities, but to do it in a way that feels equitable is less common. Keith, can you chime in from the perspective of WA Sandalwood Plantations and what brought you to do this partnership with Duchan, to create Duchan?
I mean, obviously for us, I mean, Clinton talks about trees that are, you know, 50 to 300 years old. In the plantation environment, of course, we're dealing in a much more, or a much younger product. And plantation wood absolutely has its own benefits and criteria. And interestingly, is extremely complementary to wildwood. They're quite different. And we kind of recognized fairly early on that to go to market with a plantation product and to try and educate a market over a reducing wild resource and try and get them to switch straight to a plantation resource was just, you know, that was not going to happen. And the transition that we talk about needs to be a staged one and needs to be thought through. But the more that we began to mature as a business, the more aware of the history of sandalwood from an Indigenous perspective we became, the more we started to look at the marketplace and look at wood that came from Clinton's areas and from you know, the Aboriginal communities generally, the quality of that wood and the characteristic of it and the olfactory of it was really quite different to the plantation wood. And so when Clinton mentions that contract, that government contract that they bid for downstream processing, we as a plantation group bid for the same contract, and we were unsuccessful. And what then happened was we were both trying to get to the same place, but from totally different resources. But we were quite aware that there was complementary aspects between traditional native wildwood and plantation wood. And so that's where the kind of approach and an appropriate time came between the two groups, where really Clinton and the Dutch Island Custodians had this dream of Clinton's father to have this Indigenous brand in the marketplace. And WA Sandalwood Plantations, you know, could provide a conduit to an international marketplace because we were already selling an element, some amount of oil and quite a lot of wood into varying marketplaces. And both parties had this real passion for the future sustainability of sandalwood as a species and for Santalum spicatum. And so when you share a room with people like that, you very quickly find out the commonalities you have. And I think that was the essence of it, that we kind of was stumbled across each other through a through parallel applications for a certain downstream processing, and it kind of fate played its hand, and the complementary nature between the woods and the derivative oils from those woods was also complemented by the people on both sides who saw this as a 50-50 joint venture from the start. So there was never any aspect of trying to have, you know, the extra ace up the sleeve. And that does bring problems. You know, people for years have said, well, yeah, but surely you've got a vote somewhere. Surely it's not really 50-50, is it? And it absolutely is, because the very nature of that means you're brought to the table and some things are easy to get through and some things we have to work through and really have to understand each other's perspective. And that's been part of the great part of the journey. We've each learned a lot from each other.
Clinton, can you speak some more about, so when you all were looking at this partnership, you had mentioned that in the past, sometimes you would get like 10% when you would be selling the sandalwood. And what were some of the key conditions that were important to you all to make sure we're in the partnership, to make sure it was something you would commit to that felt equitable?
Well, we felt that when we joined with them and created DSO with Ron and Keith, we felt that we seen that everything was going to be transparent and we were going to be, you know, always be part of the decision making and all that, you know. If Keith was to go and talk, you know, on my behalf, when we give, as Indigenous people, we give permission to talk on our behalf, it's the authority from our people. And we felt that they was really respectful and they was always, you know, we'll, before they made any decision, that we'll talk about it and we'll all agree. And because that didn't happen in the past, and people will tell us that now, if you want anything, you just get it from us, you know. But we are equal, both sides, you know. We are treated equally, and we felt that from the beginning when we first had our meeting, and we felt that we can learn from each other, you know, and to better deliver, you know, a product to the world, you know, and sharing our story to the world. We felt that, you know, with this partnership, they was already established, and we knew that they was going to do the right thing by us. So, and that is why we felt comfortable from the beginning. It took off then. It's been an amazing journey from the beginning, and and we just want to continue to share that so that others can learn from us, and so that they can, you know, work with other Indigenous people, not only in Australia, but throughout the world.
Are there some key lessons you've learned or challenges that you all have faced in this partnership? Specific examples that, and then how you've addressed them?
Well, it's funny you say that, Anne, because Clinton and I had a conversation about this the other day, about, you know, what were the biggest challenges, what were the mistakes we made, what would we do differently, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I said to Clinton, you know, possibly for me and for our group, what I would like to have done better was that we were so busy trying to just do what any startup business does in terms of, you know, we're building a facility, trying to just solidify certain, you know, arrangements with customers, etc. And we were working well together in the boardroom and in the field to a certain extent. But from my side, I would have really liked to have kind of immersed myself a bit more in Indigenous culture and learned more about their side than I actually had time to do. And I think had I done that, you know, it would have given me a greater line of vision on certain things that perhaps took me longer to actually understand. But in terms of, I think, like any relationship, you know, it's the classic, you know, you've got to be honest with each other, and you've got upfront. And when things bother you, you've got to tell each other. And it really is just about treating people, you know, with respect and having a commonality of vision. And as I said, really, I think the reason that Clinton and his mob were kind of comfortable with us is that we are kind of custodians and stewards of our own resource. and our kind of community, if you like, happens to be a community more of investors. His community is a real community with a resource that's out in the Gibson Desert with the best Australian sandalwood there is. We've both got, however, you know, obligations and responsibilities that run quite parallel to one another in many ways. And so if you enter into that 50-50 basis, you've really got the foundations for a strong relationship. And like any relationship, we have our ups and downs, but we're never afraid to tell each other what we're thinking. And we're always patient and willing to look at it from each other's side. And that has allowed us to resolve any issues along the way. So I think it's that honesty. It's certainly, as I say, from my side, you know, Clinton and his people know white people's culture a bit more than vice versa, because they've had one put onto them. It's been around them for longer. A lot of people like to talk about being involved in Indigenous companies, but taking the step to actually immersing yourself in that in an equitable partnership is a completely different thing. You know, it's been an incredibly rewarding journey for all of us. Met some wonderful people. We've had some wonderful support for some amazing brands and people that have been involved for a very long time and continue to be so. And a lot of it also is the give back to the communities. So Clinton talks about getting his people back on country, and every Indigenous person I meet, it's the first thing they say to you is it's always about that relationship or caring for country, being on country, and kind of taking what you need and having that multi-generational approach to things. And that was something that was really, you know, kind of hit me between the eyes, that as Western businesses were often very, you know, a little bit myopic and, you know, a little bit short-sighted, and their approach to doing things is something that just sat very well from us, partly because we're in a very long-term rotation type business ourselves. You know, we're always 10 or 20 year thinkers, but these guys are hundreds of years thinkers. And that seems to be common to all Indigenous peoples that I've met around the world, which is, again, is another fascinating aspect of transferring this model into other Indigenous, non-Indigenous partnerships in other parts of the world.
Thank you. I could respond, but Clinton, I want to allow you to join in and say what you've learned from the partnership and what challenges you've encountered.
Well, the challenges we had was in the beginning when I was harvesting and on my land, but we've always had the government used to give us the license only for 12 months. And by the time the government was issued the license, it was always late. And by the time it's in the wet season, and in our culture, that's when law and culture start. And we couldn't use the roads during that time. So the government didn't understand that. They didn't. So when we started working with Ron and Keith, they started helping us getting people in the government to help support us. Other people joined in, and we've before we won the award in New York, the Quetta Prize, and that's when we used that time to approach the government, you know, and ask them that look at getting a longer term license for 3 years, because the government who was issuing the private contract, theirs was longer term, you know, and we wanted the same for us. So we started working and lobbying together, and that's when we, you know, with Ron and Keith, their knowledge, and they was able to help us, and so many other people and people in government that helped us also to get the longer term license, and it makes it more viable for us, you know, as a business. as a community, because we never received money funding from the government. Dad started the community off, and he always wanted to, you know, never rely on funding from the government, but create our own employment so that we can, you know, keep our community going and, you know, still have that connection to country where we felt comfortable, you know? When we met and formed this partnership, we was able to work together strongly and get this in place. And also, we've learned other things. We've learned using new technology, because I learned from the old people how they did it back in the beginning. It was the hard way and really difficult time. I've seen the changes in the sandalwood industry. I grew up seeing it and how it changed over the years. When we first started off, Dad used to use axe to debark the wood. Really hard labor, you know, sitting in a tree, under the tree, in the middle of summer in Australia, you get cooked out, yeah? It's really in a harsh environment. And yeah, I've seen the hard way how it's been done back then. But now with the help, we're working with new technology, better machinery that helps us, you know, get the wood out much easier. Even though we've got the new technology, we still rely on our old knowledge. When that fails, we still got to rely on our old knowledge to survive out in that harsh environment. But yeah, well, since we've been working with Ron and Keith, they've helped us in that area where we can use better, you know, better equipment, better technology to do the harvesting in a better and different way, you know, and better makes it more, brings back more income to the community. And that benefit flows back not only to my community, the Kurukawa Aboriginal community, but we also pay royalties that benefit the whole town of Wuluna. And I've mentioned when our people are practicing law and culture, and there are people coming from the east across the border, like Western Australia and South Australia, Northern Territory. We've got, because of our history in the past through intermarriage, and families are still over there, and they always, when they come to practice the law and culture, the benefit flows back to families also. So it's it goes a long way when, you know, from creating an employment that Dad had. And now I felt that we went through the hard bit, the old people did the hard part. And now we are in the part of the journey now where it's getting easier and easier. There's always still challenges, but I've always relied, you know, on thinking about the old people. They give me inspiration from living in a harsh environment and how they've lived and survived. That's always my inspiration, my dad and my old people who survived the desert, such a harsh environment. And now you've got people like Ron and Keith and many other people who helped us on this journey, who joined our journey. And it's rewarding and helps out a lot. And yeah, it's benefiting more and more of our people, which, you know, we formed the foundation, the K Farmer Dutchan Foundation, after my dad. And that's starting to do programs that's helping not only the old people, but young people also now. So we wanting to look after your younger generation who's coming up so they can learn about their culture and learn about our old people and know their history, know their heritage, so that they too can take up the responsibility of caretaking the land. Yeah.
Can you talk some about the Ranger program? Because that's what that's doing, right?
Yeah, we're slowly getting into it. It's we've got Ranger programs on the land side, which with the adults, but we're looking at a Ranger program to with the kids, so that you know they can learn, you know, what the tree is about. Where the trees come from and how far it goes, you know? So from out in the bush and then taking it down to the factory and then showing where it goes, how far this, the product from their land goes and throughout to the world, you know? And yeah, it's an amazing journey, you know? Amazing story. That we want to use to encourage young people so they too can be inspired, you know, and so they can not feel that they are lost. Because when they haven't got that connection with land and haven't got anything special, they don't feel, they feel, sometimes they feel not special, so this is a special journey that we're gonna teach young people so that they can take up the responsibility and to caretake on the land and continue our culture, you know, and our story, telling it to the world, which is a special story.
Do you find, and how does the younger generation, how are they responding?
I think they, yeah, starting to get excited because we've only started just recently because Keith mentioned, when we started the business, we just focused on getting that established and getting the product out into the world, to the world market, to the big brands. And most of our energies was focused on that. But now we only just started recently, last year. And the young people are starting to get excited and they want to learn. We've given like VR headsets through the foundation we bought for the school so they can see, like our people are visual learners, so for them to see on these things, we want to create a video showing how far from out in the desert and all that journey we're seeing. We want to create a video one day so we can show that not only to the kids, but eventually to our customers, so that they can see how far, you know, throughout the supply chain. Yeah.
Yeah. If I could just add to that, and perhaps the foundation, which, as Clinton says, is named after his father, and has had a very strong charter that we've not quite honestly been able to dedicate either the time or the resource or the funds to, because we were running so hard. But we've merely made some huge strides in that over the last 18 months. We've onboarded a really strong commercial partner, a big global name, who's been supporting Clinton and his community since the early 2000s. So both the Givaudan and Estée Lauder groups have been very strong supporters of Clinton and his people for close to 20 years. You know, that they've really helped to move this story along in the right way, from what was a community that received about a tenth of what they receive today in terms of their wood value. They didn't have native title exclusive possession on their land. They didn't have a right to resource on their land. All of those things they now do have. And that allows them to focus on some of the charter points of the foundation and some of the really kind of work to be done in Wiluna and other communities. And we're starting to see, you know, particularly customers wanting to contribute to the Ken Farmer Foundation themselves and help to make a difference around the educational aspect. And some of that's in the Ranger program, some of it's in education in Wiluna, some of it's particularly around Matu mothers. There are a number of initiatives happening there that are really quite exciting, and we're able now to start to focus on.
So going, and I just wanted to mention, going back, we won a native title in 2018, but it took 20 years to fight to get our land back. And even though the old people fully didn't understand the process, but they felt that they needed to, you know, do what they can to get the land back. And in when Dad first went out back into our land, that inspired them to fight hard, the old people, to get it back. I mentioned earlier the hard bit been done, because that's when they started the journey, the old people, when they, you know, started fighting to get their land back. And it took a lot of long, hard journey, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And now many of them old people, we've lost them in that fight, and they many of them passed on after we received the land. And I always acknowledge the old people. They is the one that done the hard part for us. And if it wasn't for them, the young people wouldn't survive today now. And we just want to continue on to tell our story and to honor them, because without them and without our land, I wouldn't be here today now existing, telling our story. And I always go back to acknowledging our people, our old people.
Thank you. I'm looking at some of the questions in the chat, which we're not going to really have time to go into. There's a lot of information on both the Duchan Oil Sandalwood Oil website, as well as the WA Plantation website. And I'll share those links later. I wanted to draw out a little bit more. So Clinton and Keith, you all have this unique relationship that seems built on trust and openness and honesty. And I wanted to know more about what you're doing to ensure that the equity stays intact if, you know, as you all move into different roles or, you know, as those sort of things change, that it can't, the importance of a personal relationship, but they're also, you know, how you're making sure that is in the bylines or whatever the structure of the partnership.
That makes sense. Absolutely. I mean, I think, obviously, you know, a number of those things also come down to, you know, just classic old corporate documentation being appropriate. So we were set up correctly. We've got very strong kind of shareholder agreements that represent the interests of both parties. But I think more than that, and kind of what's more relevant to today, is that we've really focused on global certifications. So, you know, things like SEDEX and EcoVadis, you know, we've had for some time. You know, we're HACCP certified. But more importantly, we are now provisionally UEBT certified, and we've also been looking at the For Life certifications, and all of those, I'm sure a number of your listeners are very familiar with, and they do reach right down into fairness in terms of work conditions, in terms of pay, in terms of all the things you would expect when, in particular, you're dealing with remote communities who for many years have been disadvantaged and in many ways still are. So those third party certifications, I think, are probably a strong endorsement that because they do reach right into what's in your filing cabinet as well as what's out in the field. So we're kind of very proud to sit there and happily be kind of very transparent about all of that documentation. Because that's the very much part of, as you just mentioned, that is, there's a strong part of the strength of this business. I mean, it is that equitable nature in a transparent way. So we will continue to do that and capture those agreements and certifications. Because when Clinton leaves and stops harvesting, which is a young man's game, and I'm not exactly a young bub anymore either, you know, we see this as a generational company. And we want to leave it in a way that on each of the partner sides, it can continue on for those generations in the manner and intent in which it was originally set up.
Thank you. Clinton, how about you? What allows you all to really trust this relationship?
Well, in the past, there's been companies and when our old people walked in from the desert, they've been burnt for many years, and we've learned who to trust and who to work with, you know? And we felt straight away when we met with WASP that that was what our vision was similar to theirs, so they wanted to work with us, and that's where we felt comfortable, and everything is all, you know, transparent, and we know that from past experience, if we didn't feel comfortable from the beginning with WASP, we wouldn't have went down this journey. So we've learned our old people that, you know, we've seen the problems they face, and we've learned what we want and what we don't want. And that's how from the beginning we felt comfortable, and now it's only going to get better where we're going to make it strong. The foundation's already established. And like for the future, you know, we know that it's going to be a strong relationship continuing on from what we started.
Mm-hmm. Coming to the end, I have a final question for each of you. Keith, I wanted to ask you, when we spoke the other day, you said all wildwood isn't the same. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, what that means to you.
Well, you know, I think the first question you asked me about was the beginning of the plantation wood side. And that was about, you know, there's been a wildwood resource that has been harvested for a very long, well, since the, I think 1843 were the first exports of wild sandwood out of Fremantle in Western Australia into Asia. And the amount of wood that went out at that time was huge. Numbers were up to 14,000 tonne plus a year in the 1920s. That was clearly not sustainable. And the type of wood that starts to go out, the more wood you harvest, the quality starts to suffer. People start to go for the younger, more accessible wood. Where Clinton is, there's nothing accessible about it. It's the most difficult place in the world to harvest sandwood, certainly in Australia. And the balance to me is always been quite obvious, is that a plantation resource can help take the pressure off a wild resource. Much of that wild resource is on Crown government land, who did a great job of developing an industry in the first place. But where we're at now really is that the complementary nature of Clinton's best wood harvested through the natural custodians of the land with a reduced overall wildwood take, supplemented by this plantation resource, is where I unashamedly want to see things go. And the wood from Clinton's difficult and remote areas to access is the best there is. A lot of the other wildwood coming out is very average. A lot of it's not any better than the plantation wood. So, you know, when you get to that point, I'd argue that you've reached the transition that is required. And as I say, that for us is a dramatic decrease in wildwood, and that should be managed by Aboriginal people for Aboriginal people under their custodianship, complemented and supplemented by the plantation wood.
And our certifications, like for those of us buying sandalwood, is a certification the way, like how do we find that quality of, to know that the wildwood has been harvested under that custodianship?
So certainly there are numerous documents, management plans that we have that we're always happy. So all the plantation wood is certified under PEFC. And Clinton's wood is going through two certifications at the moment, the UEBC being one of them. What he also currently has is a very robust management plan. So he's actually not allowed to harvest his wood without having a management plan where every single tree that he is, so the whole resource is GPS'd. Every single tree has a GPS point, and every single tree he takes has to have a GPS point. And after it's taken, the government comes back and inspects the areas to make sure the trees that were flagged to be taken are the only ones that have been taken. So that is all documented. And again, something we will always share, and we can show exactly where the resource came from within Clinton's harvest.
So, and I want to add to that, when we harvest a tree, we also replant 20 seeds, 10 in the hole where it's been, where the tree's been pulled out, and another 10 seeds ran next to the host trees. So when the seedlings start germinating, when they start growing, they also can latch on to the roots of the host tree, you know. And then we all also getting into doing more regen work with the ranger program. So Keith mentioned that we use the GPS, every trees where we harvest this GPS, not only the green trees, but also the dead trees. So, and the whole area is, we're gonna go back and do regen work. And that's what we wanna do. And there's no else in this country. There's even the government reserves, both the FPC, Forest Product Commission, and on the DVCA, on the reserves, they haven't got the seed, young trees growing. When you go to where I come from, Mangali, where we harvest, we got the youngest trees coming up, and many. And it's nowhere else you wouldn't see that. So you got the young trees and also the old trees growing. And everything is recorded and monitored so that people can see where it's coming from, you know, down through the supply chain, right back to the land, you know, where it's coming from.
That's remarkable. I have one final question, Clinton, for you. You said, I think this is in the Estee Lauder video, where if you don't know who you are and where you're from, you become a lost person. And I'd love to hear what this journey that you've been on, following your father back to this land and really bringing it into your whole community, has meant for you personally.
For me, from learning at an early age, when you're young, learning in the country, I was lucky to learn from the old people. And I was the only kid sometime at bush with the old people. And I've remembered all them stories. And after losing my dad, I went through a hard time. I gone through a bit of a depression, and it really hit me hard. And going back to country has healed me. And it reminded me and given me inspiration. When I look at, you know, on the looking out on the land, and I was thinking of my people and where my dad grew up, it's really a harsh environment. And that gave me inspiration and healing. And that's what I want to encourage my people to go back onto country. And that's what Dad's dream also was, to encourage our people to go back. Because when they came into town, living a new life, they lost that way of caretaking for country and land and staying connected. And that's how we lost a lot of our old people. And that's what Dad wanted. By creating employment back on country and staying connected to country, we'll, you know, that's, when we look after the land look after us. And that's the connection to our land. When I've been back on land working, I go to places that special to us, like where the water is, that I didn't know that, but because I had a strong connection and the knowledge how to read the land that was passed on to me from Dad and the old people, I found places where water is. And it was like, I was there before, but I haven't been there. And that's what we call connection, a spiritual connection to land. So with that land, indigenous people all over the land, all over the world, talk about this, their connection to land is special. We got a strong relationship with the land. Without the land, you know, we become lost. And that's why we always protecting the land and also the resources, and so that our people can continue on into the future, you know. And not only that, is and like what we're doing now, it's benefiting many people, not only my people, but what we're doing is bringing in money back into the country, you know, back into, and we're doing our part by contributing to the Australian economy. And our story and our product is touching many people all throughout the world. It's going a long way to many people and touching people from all different cultures. And that's what we want to continue to do and share to the world. What we had special to us, we're going to share that to the world so that many other people can experience it and see our journey, what we had to fight and work hard to get to where we are now. Like I said, it's been a special journey, and many people have joined us on the way. And I'm thankful for people who like Ron and Keith and many others who helped us on this journey, who've joined us on this journey. And, you know, like I said, I mentioned earlier from our history, our old people was hunter-gatherers living a nomadic lifestyle. A very humble beginning to see our journey from where we started to where we are now. It's amazing. And it's a special story. And when we, the highlight when we won that Equator Prize in New York, you know, it's no other Australian company has done that. We made history in doing that. And it's because of the inspiration from our old people and the land and the people who joined us on this journey. And like I said, we just want to continue to share this story and product to the world so that others can be touched by it and inspired.
Thank you so much. It's both of you. And it is a quite remarkable and inspiring story, and the quality of connection with each other and the land, I think, has lessons for all of us. And the to listen to that connection we have and to act on it. That's, Clinton, is so inspiring to hear that your story. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.